Okay, wonderful. Let's start with a little sequence.
Science claims it's working to cure disease, save the planet, and solve our greatest mysteries. But what's it really up to? From global warming...
I don't believe global warming is real.
...to evolution...
Absolutely not, I don't believe that.
...to the HPV vaccine.
Her daughter suffered mental retardation as a result of that vaccine.
It seems science is up to something.
There are a substantial number of scientists who have manipulated data so that they will have dollars rolling into their projects.
Could these Republican candidates be right? Tonight, we answer the question, science, what's it up to?
Good question, right? So how do you handle these kind of questions when they come up to you? That's the issue I want to talk about today. And I want to give you a little bit of feeling of how you might deal with journalists, what you might avoid, what might be a good idea, and how you answer funny, strange, or maybe very serious questions. I have a little brief outline what I will talk about today. First of all, I want to speak a little bit about what journalists have in mind, and I want to compare that with what a scientist might have in mind. And the question the journalist will ask compared a little bit with the questions the scientist might have or the answers he wants to give, what is not necessarily the same the journalist expects. Then I will discuss the three dimensions of an interview, and I will give you a glimpse behind the scene, how journalists set up interviews and what they know about the psychology of the whole story. And finally, I will discuss some best practice with you. Actually, I want to discuss it with you. That means this is sort of an interactive talk, so feel free to interrupt me at any time. And because it's so interactive and I like it so much, I would like to start with a little role play. I will need about 3 volunteers. I hope they are 3, otherwise I have to point them out just by chance. So better volunteer. But before you raise your hand, all of you, I tell you a little bit what the role play is about. So we will play a little scene here in the front. This is our stage. And I'm the journalist, you are the scientist, so that's very easy, okay? And we will pretend that we've just been to a party and we have been introduced to each other in the very last moment. And so you just figured out I'm a science writer and I just figured out you're a scientist and we both are in a hurry. We have to run, our cab is waiting, so we just have the elevator right down. That will give us maximum 60 seconds. And I would like a couple of volunteers, hopefully, to try that, to play with me, and to do a very, very brief discussion, maximum 1 minute, about what you're doing. Because you might want to tell me what you're doing, because you know I'm a science writer, and it's always good to know somebody in the media. And I'm also very interested in your science, because I might need you as a source or for an interview the other day. Volunteers? Well, I just walk around and pick somebody. Lars, great. Come on,
see if I can embarrass a postdoc.
No. Wonderful.
There's a hill around right there.
Huh? Where do you want me? Where do you want me?
Okay.
Since I asked you to do this, how can I help?
I think Adele raised his hand.
Well, you didn't ask for the role play. No, one is enough for the moment. I only need one and then the next one. We do 2 or 3, okay? So you're number 2? Great. Number 3? Well, there should be somebody.
Well, let's wait till after one's
okay,
done.
We wait until you're done. So the rest of you just pretend not to be here. You just listen. And Lars, also very important, he has to think there's nobody here.
We are
just
here.
You in the elevator. And for the rest of you, just to have an idea what you might look at, yeah? You want to know whether the speaker made his point. Did you understand what he said? I mean, that is probably easy for you, but not so easy for me. Was he passionate? And if you looked at his body language, did you have the impression he liked to talk to me and he would get elevated?
Now, should I act or what would you prefer?
Well, you know, I can do it
a short performance, I can do a good performance.
Well, you'll see.
I can do it twice, once good, once bad.
No, you just do one, that's fine.
I can do it like this.
So, that probably doesn't give us the impression that you're glad to talk to me. Okay, so anybody who can look at a watch for me, has got a watch or wants to use mine? You've got one. You can say beep a timer. You can say beep after 50 seconds. I would
50.
Say.
50. Yeah. 50. I can do that.
You can do that.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Okay, let's start.
Go.
So, Lars, it's great that we just met. We are both in a hurry. What science are you working on? What's interesting?
Exploding stars.
Oh, great! And what's the news about them? Is there anything I couldn't know?
Well, once per second in the universe, a star explodes.
Oh, cool. And you can see that?
Yes, not all of them. Maybe only one in a thousand right now, because we're not observing the whole sky all the time.
And what are you doing with that information?
Trying to understand how it makes elements that make you and make iron, things that run in your blood. Roughly half the iron comes from certain types of supernovae that I care about.
And where do you get the information from?
Mostly from observing in the optical, so telescopes that you're familiar with that are maybe 1 or 2 meters in diameter, that are looking up and surveying about 10% of the sky every 5 days.
Cool. And is that something you can do now and could before? Oh. Okay. That was pretty a lot, right? Okay. Do you want to answer these questions right away, or shall we just start with the next elevator rider? Okay, you can give your remarks right away.
I've never been shy about critiquing the director. So.
Well, I think you were wonderful. Yeah, that was a really.
You can say whatever you want.
No, it was a short, very short, brief interview, and I think I got a lot of information. What you do?
Okay.
I mean, I would like to talk to you one day a little bit more in detail, but I mean, for 50 seconds, that was good. You understood what he said. I also. That was good. Did you have the impression that you liked to do that?
Yes.
Yeah, he liked it? Did you like it? What was your feeling?
Oh, I love it.
You can't stop yourself.
Sorry.
Great. So I thank you very much. Okay. The next victim coming ahead. Elevator rider. Okay. It was great. It's great that we meet, but we have so little time, so you just can tell me in our short elevator ride, what science are you doing?
Well, in the area of biophysics, more particularly population genetics.
Okay. Is there maybe something you can tell me about what I can understand what it is about?
Yeah, so you know every living organism carries genetic information and or DNA,
okay.
More familiar term. And so we are trying to look at DNA of individuals in population and learn about the history of that population and the selective pressures on that population.
Okay, so is that the kind of stuff where you figure out where we come from? Like, do we have genes of Neanderthal in us? Or?
That's part of the interest, but also evolution doesn't necessarily happen over a time scale of centuries. You can observe it.
Okay. Oh dear. So we need a lot more elevator ride.
Yeah.
Do you have the impression that I got an idea what you're doing?
Not really.
Yeah, I think I got only a very.
One more minute. You were getting.
We might have gotten there.
One more minute.
So, okay. I don't know if it was my fault, but...
No, that was fine. It was just too short.
I think you should keep going for one more minute.
Yeah.
Oh, you think I should?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The elevator stops. You don't get out, it's so exciting.
Okay, you just go up again.
Well, you can go as the elevator here, it takes a minute just for the door to close.
Okay, we keep going for one more minute. Okay.
Okay.
You just were within a sentence?
Yeah, sometimes you have to go to museums to see the course of evolution, but in some organisms, like viruses, in a matter of a few weeks, you can see them change. That's, for example, why you keep, for example, HIV is a good case that it's changing and we can't cure it because it keeps changing. And
so you are studying the genome of viruses, is that
that's
right?
That's a good part of what it is.
But you are a physicist, right?
Exactly.
So where's that connection? You stand in a lab looking at viruses, or you get information from the biologist? How does it work?
No, I don't work in the lab. We get information from biologists. And if I give you an example to understand what we do better, imagine for the first time you sit in a car. So by just pushing the buttons, you learn quite a bit about how things work. But if you really want to understand how a car works, you need to understand it in greater details. And that's how we use our physics background to learn about this process. But I don't know if I can explain it in more detail now.
2 seconds.
Yeah. I think with the two of us, we have to meet somewhere else.
Yeah.
Invest a little bit more time. It was very interesting. Thank you very much. Did you have the impression he enjoyed it? Did he like it?
No.
Yeah, he did?
After the elevator came to a stop, he liked it a lot better.
Do you mean that he loves what he's doing, or that he loves talking to you? I mean, he loves being interviewed.
Well, he loves the interaction. I was asking about the interaction, that's it.
But interaction,
he liked talking. He liked talking, well, but he liked explaining his subject, yeah? Did you understand what he's doing?
Yes.
The special point? Did he make his point?
Yes, by invoking the viruses, yeah.
So you need a little bit of background, right? Okay, great, good. Anybody else? One more example? Yeah, come on. But this time only 1 minute because we have to go through a lot of information today.
I was disappointed in the last one that you didn't get more about Neanderthals. That you kind of left that.
Yeah, well, he went to viruses.
He quickly went to viruses.
Yeah, that's obviously what he's doing. I mean,
I think what he's doing is more general.
Oh, you think so?
That was the impression I got.
Okay, I will try that again. Okay, so what is your science about?
So I try to look at when you see effects of quantum mechanics on large scales with large numbers of particles, because most of the time we could forget about quantum mechanics. Most of the world, you don't really need to worry about quantum mechanics to see how it works, except very occasionally. There's all things where quantum mechanics has big effects, and that's what I look at.
So where has it affects the
So superconductors. Superconductors work because of quantum mechanics. You see collective behavior of large numbers of electrons behaving in identical quantum mechanical way, and because of that you get transport of electricity without resistance.
So you can explain superconductivity?
So that's been explained for 50 years or so. What I look at is other places where quantum mechanics has that kind of large-scale effect, where you need to worry about the quantum mechanics.
So what are you looking at?
What I look at in particular are things with light strongly coupled to matter. So excitations in electronic materials coupled to light, and trying to...
Poor guy.
That's a good sentence too. Sorry.
Okay. Did you understand what this guy is working on?
Yes.
Well, some say yes, because they're probably the same group. Well, I got an idea, but not very specific, because it's not the superconductor. I would have liked what he's actually doing. Yeah. Did you have the impression he made his point?
Yep. I think he made a point to us, but I'm not sure he would have made the point to a journalist, unless it was a very specialized journalist.
Okay.
I think like the last time, if we had another minute, we would have gotten...
There was a minute that my problem is Lars said I should be done in 40 minutes. Uh-huh. How serious were you about the 40 minutes?
It's good to have a goal.
Well, yeah, I can give him another minute,
sure.
But then don't blame me if the whole thing is a little bit... I can rush through the program. Okay, you want to give him another minute?
Sure.
Okay, one more minute. So what is it? Not the superconductor.
So it's a thing called a polariton condensate. A polariton is a mixture of light that permeates with a photon and an excitation in a semiconductor. So it's light coupled to semiconductors. And these are experiments which are done at relatively low temperatures in labs in small bits of semiconductors, so tiny bits of crystal. But you can start to see effects of quantum mechanics and actually see it on scales of a millimeter or so. So getting towards a scale that you can actually see things and trying really to work out what this could be useful for. But it shows a lot of strange properties that not many other materials show, and we don't quite yet know what to use it for.
Sorry, I didn't get it. I think even an extra minute does not really help us. We need some drawing or whatever. Thank you very, very much. So you saw it's not that easy. Okay? I think that's as far as we got here. It's not easy. And the reason it's not easy is that we have different background, of course. I mean, I know a lot less about your science than you do, quite obviously. And the other reason is you have other things in mind. And to make you understand that difference, I want to give you a glimpse in a journalist's mind. A journalist...
Doesn't it vary tremendously between subjects, some of which are much more familiar to journalists and the general public than others are? Some much easier to describe in 1 minute?
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, that's obvious. Yeah. But still, I mean, no matter what science it is, a scientist thinks about science and about his fellow scientists. And that's basically the dimensions he has. I will point that out a little later. And the journalist thinks about his publication, about his editor, about his audience. And to be a little bit more specific, he thinks about how he wants to sell the story and where the news is. Yeah? So if I don't understand the news of something the scientist is telling me, it's a little bit hard to contact an editor and say, well, this is my story I want to do.
What do you call the news? Is it that something is very new? Isn't
it
to you? Or is it
No. In general, new, not new to me. I mean, I can be completely ignorant, and you tell me something. I mean, you tell me that evolution has just been, somebody has found out that there is evolution, right? And this is not really news. So, I mean, if I go somewhere and want to sell a story telling them that I just figured out that, I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Yeah. No, it has really to be new.
So you would like people also to understand the context of it and the sense of this new?
Yeah, right. And the news has to be understandable to a broader public. I mean, just one little detail, the editor might not like that, and the audience might not understand it. What is so specific, so interesting that we have to write about it. Okay, but I mean, these are things I have in mind. How do I sell a story? How do I find out, just give me a second, how do I find a way the audience understands what I'm talking about? And I also try to reflect when I talk to you, well, is this person I'm just talking to, is that somebody I want to call up if I need somebody for an interview or a statement, or is it not? Is it complicated? So all these things work in the back of my mind, yeah?
I was just wondering, when Laura said something like, you know, this is about, like, what's inside you, you know, what's inside people and stuff like, you know, relating, did that make it seem like more of a human interest story? What we're all made of. You said something like that, right? Did that make it, was that specifically a line for journalists, or?
Oh, why did I say that?
Yeah, you said that the irony we have in our body.
Why it matters.
Yeah.
So you were very prepared for that sort of public image.
He's obviously done that before.
Yes.
And when the last speaker said, we don't know how we would use this, is that something that journalists go, oh, well, forget it then? You know, it's not interesting. I mean, I don't think that, but I'm wondering if that would seem that way.
Well, this is a bigger discussion, yeah? What a journalist might think is a story or is not a story. But, I mean, just the remark that he said, well, we might not know by now, does not kill a story necessarily. But it's not really a door opener either. So,
okay.
I mean, that I would say that's neutral. Okay, let me come back to my different minds of journalists and scientists. I have prepared a little chart that gives you a little overview what different expectations there might be if we stand in that elevator together. So what I expect is give me the news and answer the questions, why are you doing that, what is it good for, maybe with whom and what is it about, that's the big W's, while a scientist tends to explain a broader context first, right? So that was basically what happened here. The thing started with a broad context, well, big field, and I might be somewhere involved, but the involvement of the news comes last when a scientist speaks. For a journalist, he wants it first. And the journalist also looks for explanations that are easy to understand, while a scientist has a tendency to say something correct that other scientists like it. That sometimes has bizarre consequences. It happened to me a couple of times that I went somewhere and said I want an interview with an expert, and he said, yeah, you're welcome. So we found a special day, I went there, and he had invited about five or six of his colleagues. They were sitting in a big circle around me, making sure that the scientist that was talking to me didn't say anything wrong. I mean, this is a killer. If you want to kill an interview, do it that way. Because there will never be a natural interaction between you and a journalist, that's a very personal psychological thing, if you have an audience with you. And you will always think about the audience, about your fellow scientists. You will say, oh, but this guy is the expert for that. Ask him. Then that poor journalist has to focus on another person in between. I mean, some journalists need that, they will tell you. But if the journalists don't ask for it, better don't do it. So the important thing is an interaction, right? So, and last but not least, the journalists like short sentences and statements, and the expert wants to put everything in one sentence, if that's possible. So these differences are nothing you can do about. It's just important that you know them, that you've seen them, and you know, okay, that's the way it is. And if you know it, then you might not be surprised by the outcome. That might not be in the way you expect it to be. That happens very often. Okay, so now let me come to my next and last chart that, I thought you're a physicist, you like dimensions. So I made up something for you. This is progressively going down to be more complex, I would say. So the easiest interaction with a journalist would be that a journalist gives you a call or sends an email and says, I need an explanation or a short statement. That is not very time consuming, you can do it in a minute, and that was it. More time consuming, more complex is it if a journalist comes to you and actually wants to speak with you, that interview interaction. So you have the psychological thing of a person coming to your room, or at least on the line. I would recommend telephone interviews and personal interviews to email interviews. If you can avoid it, don't do an email interview, because until the next question comes, you have completely forgotten what you have written him last time, so you always have to get into it again, and it's sort of out of the context. I don't have a good experience with that. Some experts love it, because it gives them the freedom to go everywhere they want to go, but it's better just to be on the phone, or even better to be in the same room. And depending on whether it will be printed as an interview in the newspaper or in the magazine, or it will be used for a background story, the interview will be a little bit different, because the journalist, if it's printed as an interview, Dr. Sowieso says this and that, and then the question is this and that, then the journalist has to prepare the questions in a way that he sort of producing a red line, he's articulating the questions the audience might have. So this is a little bit more difficult. Also for you, you have to focus very much on that. And if it's just used for background, then the journalist can use what he needs. And one dimension more is the voice is included. So the grammar has to be right, and your pronunciation has to be good. There has to be a little voice melody, and the voice has to go down after each sentence. Yeah. So somebody who always speaks in the same level and never makes a point is very hard to edit. And last but not least, the fourth dimension, now even the face comes in. So it's also important not only how your voice is and whether you stumble around, no, it also is interesting how you look at the camera and whether you smile or are a friendly person or you're not and only look at your shoes. So these are the different dimensions. Last but not least, there is a live interview for TV. That's the most demanding one. That could be the fourth dimension. And now I want to show you a first example, and we will discuss that. So what you might have in the back of your mind is the person that's interviewed here. It's Lisa Randall, you probably all know her. Does she make her point? Do you understand what she wants to say? Is she passionate? How is her body language? So same questions again, just for the back of your mind. Just watch it and tell me, then we will discuss what do you think about the interview. I guess there are a couple of things. So let's see, I would like
Lisa to Randall's
push that a little forward. Okay. So she,
as always, I'm pleased to have her back at this thing. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank
so this is a new e-book. What does that mean, e-book?
You know, it was an interesting experiment. It was just, I wrote Knocking on Heaven's Door. It came out last year, and it's coming out. But since I wrote that book,
it's coming back,
they had
paperback.
That's right. And since then, they had this discovery. And so I was very excited, and I was also frustrated because I was away and I just wanted to tell people what it meant. Like I was reading the news stories and I thought a lot of people asked a lot of questions. So I just thought to write a short ebook as just an opportunity to sort of answer those questions, not to tell everything that's in the book.
But it's always good to review exactly why this is important, exactly what they discovered, and exactly where they're going now.
So the one thing is we don't know exactly what they discovered, and that's the answer to the question of where they're going now. But let's backtrack and talk about what they're looking for. So basically, so it's important in the sense that it's important for particle physicists. It won't make a difference in your daily life, at least not tomorrow. But what it's telling us is where elementary particles, the fundamental building blocks of matter, acquire their mass. How do they acquire their mass? I mean, that sounds like a really strange concept because you think particles had masses from the get-go. But it turns out your theory would be inconsistent. You would make nonsensical predictions. You would make a mechanism, some way in which these particles acquire their masses. And what the Higgs boson does, it tells you that the mechanism called the Higgs mechanism is correct. It tells you that this is how elementary particles...
Oh, sorry.
Particles acquire their masses. But you want to know what was there that gave them that hit, what induced the Higgs mechanism in the first place. You know, we're not just looking we're really looking for the forces. What is the nature of forces? What is the nature of physics
and that's
at
what
those
the
scales?
Explains.
Well, the Higgs boson.
Forces?
The Higgs boson is in some sense it induces a force, a new type of force. But what it's really doing is completing the standard model. In the standard model, we assume particles acquire their masses through this Higgs mechanism. But there was clearly this missing ingredient. There had to be something responsible for it. And so this Higgs boson is sort of the completion. And it didn't have, I mean, one of the things that was so interesting about this discovery is it didn't have to look like this. There are other types of particles, other sectors that can make the Higgs mechanism work. The Higgs boson is in some sense the simplest possibility, but it could be more complicated. And that's one of the reasons that the experiments are now studying in detail the properties of the Higgs boson to find out, is it really the simplest example that implements this mechanism, or is it something richer and deeper that sheds light on what goes beyond?
Do you consider it the greatest discovery in the 21st century?
Well, as far as I know...
That's a different way. If not this, what would it be?
Well, you know, it could, in the future, as far as particle physics goes, I mean, there's a lot of reasons to think the Higgs boson is not the end of the story.
Ah, so where do we go from here?
Exactly. So the Higgs boson, so it tells you that particles are quark.
Okay. I would stop here and ask you, how did you like?
Well, everything she said was correct. We can give her that.
Okay.
I have another question. Are people usually presented with the questions before the interview, or they don't know the questions?
That's a very, very good question. I wanted to come to that point later, but I can do it right now. Well, of course, she had spoken with Charlie Rose about what she would say, I would guess. I mean, he's recommending her book. He's talking about her e-book, and obviously he invited her, obviously, because of that event, the Higgs boson was found. Okay? So, but the question was, do they always get the questions? As I pointed out before, an interview should be something dynamic. So it's an interaction between two people. If you insist on having all the questions ahead, we will sit there, and I've seen that in a lot of interviews you find on YouTube. There's a person sitting with a big sheet and reading these questions, and on the other side sits somebody answering these questions. There's no connection between the question and the answers and so on. There's no red line. There is no reason you want to watch that to the end. So, just only with the prepared questions, this is not a good interview. Yeah? But on the other hand, of course, it's obvious that we agree before what we talk about, right? And that we talk about the questions that might be asked about the field where we are in. So if you have contact with a journalist, make sure you know what he wants, but don't insist on pre-fixed questions. So I would recommend that. Okay, but in terms of did she know the questions, I had a different feeling when I saw that interview. Who is asking the questions in that interview?
There aren't many questions.
There weren't any. She asked them herself.
But then, I mean,
the first time he jumps in is in the end, where he says, oh, now we are coming to something.
I'm not sure he could ask questions, because I don't think he understood what she said, because she used terminology that was just so out of context.
Did he understand?
You
think he didn't understand?
Yeah. I think it's not only the terminology. She was talking, just talking. She couldn't really stop the question. It wasn't entertaining.
It was not entertaining. Well, I would say she's an expert, right? She's done that a million times, obviously, and she wants to come here and sell her book. So that's her message. I understand it that way. She's written a book, and she has an e-book, and she wants to tell people that this is out there, and this event is that something was found, and she's invited. So.
Well, she fell into a lot of what have become cliches, I think, in this particular subject. That is, she's talking about the generation of mass and the mechanism. You know, she uses the word mechanism a couple of times. A sector, someone said. You know, she's using these terms which you can go to any interview about the Higgs and probably hear the same exact terms used in more or less the same way. It's as if she started on a track and she just had to go kind of just follow that track in a cliched way to its conclusion, and didn't allow him to, you know, interrupt. Really, it didn't allow her to get off of the track, and you know, it just made a very stale kind of impression.
And that track is really not very understandable to the average person.
So you were more critical than I was.
I mean, you can say words like mechanism for giving particles mass, but what is a particle to somebody who's not a scientist? Like, what does that even mean? What is a mechanism? What is a mechanism in the context of mass? Like, all of these things are totally foreign to the average person. So.
Yeah, I think he should have pushed a little bit more forward and interrupt her and ask more questions. If
he should have stopped her, is what he should have done. the thing is, so I read part of the book that she's talking about, and a decent chunk of the book is devoted not just to what is the physics of this, it's also devoted to what was the process of finding it like? What were people going through? There were all these rumors on these blogs, and people were excited about it. So there's sort of this whole interesting story that was covered in her book that wasn't even addressed at all because she sort of just kept going. And we were talking earlier about how there's a difference between the interesting answer and the correct answer. And she was actually more nuanced in her answer than many people are. When you hear this, from experts who are talking about this, they'll broadly say the Higgs boson gives things mass, right? But she actually made very clearly the statement that it gives the elementary particles the mass, which is the correct statement. And she should have just stopped there, and I don't know why she didn't. I mean, that's an interesting thing, right, Greg? But she used all these words and then kept going. So she should have said electron, right? Why does the electron have a mass?
It's an electron. It's not actually too far. I mean, like, you can say things like protons and electrons make up atoms that make up us.
Wait a second. I think on the content, I think she was pretty good on the content. It's not really the question of the content, and maybe you could do better than her, but who cares in a sense? It's just on the way she interacts with the journalist that there was no interaction, but on the content, I think she was super, personally. It was, at least for a scientist, it was perfectly clear, and she didn't make any mistakes. So, in what she said.
I would agree. I'm surprised that Charlie Rose let it go that long.
Yeah,
to me, that was the surprise.
Yeah, for me also, because
he has too many jobs right now, right?
He lets her speak for 2.5 minutes.
Yeah.
Without interrupting, without saying, "Oh, can you maybe explain that a little bit more in detail or whatever?" Yeah. Okay, but I think it wasn't a bad interview after all. So, and her message was just she wanted to talk about it, and she has a book or an e-book or whatever. Okay,
One point was when they, at a certain point, they showed the interviewer that was so funny. He was like, what are you, completely not following. So I think, you know, that sometimes it happens when you give a seminar that you lose your audience. So you should really all the time focus, also when you speak to a journalist, I guess, to focus on someone, that somebody is listening.
Yeah, obviously he was lost.
He was like, so, the greatest discovery of the 21st century?
Yeah, right. I mean, this question was, I think he just was lost. Yeah. This is a question you can ask about everything. I always personally think that this question is a little bit funny. I mean, we are writing the year 2012, and people are talking about the greatest discovery of the century already. So what are you going to do with the rest of the time? I want to give you a short glimpse behind the scene. To do an interview is not that easy, as we have seen. Yeah, and there are some things journalists know how they prepare for an interview to make you a good interviewee. And I want to share that knowledge with you, that you have a little bit of an idea what might happen if that happens to you. So basically, the journalist has a tendency to make you to feel happy. So he will choose a setting or find a place for you to sit that you feel comfortable, that you are happy, that you start talking. The easier you talk and the less you think about your colleagues and other things that you might have in mind, the better the interview will be. So the journalist will promote that. So he will show you enthusiasm and interest in your issue and try to sort of pull you out of the hole. The interest and all these wonderful things around you that might happen, it does not necessarily mean that you are in a real dialogue with the journalist, because the dialogue is always asymmetrical. There's one asking the question and one giving the answers. This is just interesting to know, because I figured out a lot of scientists don't realize that. They really think that is the sort of dialogue I personally like, and are very astonished if you meet them one day for a glass of wine in the evening, and you are not always sitting there and just looking at them. So that happened very often to me in the time where I was doing radio pieces, because as a radio reporter, you're not allowed to speak. While the guy talks, you hold the mic and you shut your mouth, because you can't edit otherwise. And so they are used to you just sit there and look at them and smile. Okay, anyway. So the journalist, it's asymmetrical because, first of all, the journalist holds his mouth and lets you speak. They just ask questions. And the other thing is, the journalist thinks about his audience. So he has always sort of this role that gives him a double role. On one hand, he's there as an individual. On the other hand, he's sort of the speaker or the questioner for the audience. Okay, and if the interview is recorded, what most likely will happen, what is recorded is on the record. That means you can be quoted. You just have to be aware that this is the case. If you don't want that, if you want to be off the record, you have to tell the journalist to switch off the recording machine, or definitely not take notes, and really take it as something you talk to him, or you want to tell him. Under four eyes. Okay. As I mentioned before, you cannot control the outcome. Once you have talked to somebody and he has recorded it, you can't say, no, I haven't said it. So. Also, you just have to be aware. It's nothing that's really so bad. So I have another example now for you that you might watch and discuss. I'm very curious how critical you are with that guy. So I used a different story this time. It's about Fukushima, and we have, can roll that a little bit forward.
For physics at City University of New York, his latest...
No, sorry, I will make it somehow. Just let it run from the beginning.
Michio Kaku is a renowned physicist, television host, and best-selling author, and professor of physics at City University of New York. His latest best-selling text is called Physics of the Future: How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. He joins us tonight from Chicago. Dr. Kaku, good to have you on this program, sir. Glad to be on. Let me start with a couple of questions relative to news of the day about Japan. So we have another aftershock today on the anniversary of the initial earthquake and tsunami. You have argued of late that we need to entomb this reactor that is still concerning so many in Japan, and for that matter around the world. There are others who disagree with that approach. Your thoughts first?
Yes, first of all, the reactors in Japan are stable in the same way that a ticking time bomb is also stable. It doesn't take much to light the fuse. A 6.6 earthquake like what happened today in Japan, a pipe break, an overpressurized containment vessel, anything could set it off, in which case we would have another Chernobyl, three times the magnitude of a Chernobyl accident. And that's why I say that we should, as a last resort, prepare to entomb the reactors in concrete, sand, and boric acid.
There are folks who say that's too risky. Your response?
It's risky to allow radiation to constantly go up into the atmosphere. The main criticism of this approach of entombing it is that it would cost too much, involve too many resources and people. But think of the cost of having all the crops impounded by the government, all the milk being thrown into the river, people's livelihoods destroyed. Every day, more radiation seeps out, causing panic in China, Korea, and even in the United States. The ultimate damage could be billions of dollars extra, when entombing the reactor would only involve a few $100 million.
To your point now, Professor Kaku, how concerned should we be here in the States about radioactive water, since we keep reading every day about this activity in the ocean?
Radioactive milk has already been found in the United States at the level of about 3 picocuries per liter. That's roughly the legal limit. However, it is very, very low. No need for panic. And in fact, all of us have a piece of Chernobyl in our bodies going back to 1986. Back then, we had an accident much larger than the Fukushima reactor accident. Cesium iodine from the Chernobyl reactor accident went around the world many times, and everyone on the earth has a piece of Chernobyl in their bodies, but it's very tiny, too small to cause much damage.
How has this radioactivity in Japan impacted the debate about nuclear power and nuclear safety in this country? Put another way, have we advanced the conversation? Have we taken this issue seriously enough, given the warning that we have, courtesy of Japan?
This is a game changer. You realize that in Germany, they've canceled a whole series of nuclear power plants and basically have thrown in the towel with regards to nuclear. In the United States, President Barack Obama is poised to initiate a new generation of nuclear power plants in the United States, and the debate is already starting in the halls of Congress. Now, in Japan, they've made the Faustian bargain. Faust was this mythical figure who sold his soul to the devil for unlimited power. The Japanese have made that Faustian bargain because they don't have coal, oil, or hydropower. However, the United States has a choice. And this is definitely going to spin the conversation, spin the debate, as we begin to grapple with what could happen in the United States. Because we also have reactors on earthquake faults. We have the Indian Point nuclear power plant north of New York City, where I live. And in fact, it's right near the Ramapo Fault. And in fact, the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, calls it one of the most hazardous reactors in terms of earthquake damage. California has 2 nuclear power plants near the San Andreas Fault, Diablo Canyon between San Francisco and Los Angeles, and also the San Onofre reactor between San Diego and Los Angeles.
Gives us real hope, huh? Okay, what do you think?
Why is he talking on this subject?
good question, yeah?
I think he's excellent. I personally think he's...
I guess that's the answer to your question.
This is not his science at all.
No, of course not.
But he had a very clear message he wanted to get across for each body.
Yeah, he's good.
I've never been forced to watch him before, because whenever he comes on the radio, I turn it off or something. But I have to say, I'm impressed, because he gets across very forcefully a message, and he's got a lot of skills. You know, he inflects his voice at the right time, he uses analogy constantly.
He answers the questions.
There was one, so at least one, when he was asked about radioactive water, he ignored the question entirely and talked about radioactive milk.
Yeah, he did shift it.
He answered the question he wanted to answer.
Yeah, right. No, but his question was, why the hell is that guy answering the questions? And I don't know that from this country. I'm just not familiar enough with that, but I know it from Germany. There are always the same experts coming up, right? There are experts you can ask on everything, every issue of the world, and they will give you good answers. And the TV people know that, and they look good, and they don't have the tendency to call them.
My question was partially rhetorical, because the reason why they're interviewing him is because he's good at speaking to journalists. This is not his science.
That's exactly what I mean.
Be careful to define his term. Even the NRC, which I think most people would know what it is, but he was careful to say what the initials stood for.
Explain who Faust was. he's giving a little lesson in European literature and history. You know, that's I mean, there's a reason he's the go-to person for many, you know, media outlets, I guess.
But in contrast to the last interview, he didn't stray into scientific jargon about nuclear power. He kept things, like Greg said, he kept things on using analogy and on a basic understandable level that could get across what's happened with just enough science that people can get it, but not too much to get to now.
But I don't think that's a fair comparison because I think the topics are very different. The first topic is so abstract. I mean, second topic is so popular science-y that it's very easy to get it across.
They're also qualitatively different things. He's being asked, what should we do about, or how should you respond, or why does this matter to your life? Whereas Lisa Randall was really being asked, why is this interesting? And there's quite a difference in those kinds of questions.
I don't know whether I have in mind she was asked, what is an e-book?
she never asked that question.
She's never being asked questions about what should a public policy response be to something.
Right, she never was asked the question. So we just learned the Higgs boson was found. What does that mean?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it is possible to take the reactor issues and turn them into an incredibly scientific, dense, non-understandable discussion.
Of course.
And he didn't do that. Not that he even could do that. As was pointed out, it's not his specialty. But maybe it's also possible to take something as complicated as the Higgs and not turn it into such a thing.
I think it depends what your intention in when you're speaking is. So his intention is to influence the way that people act, to stop them panicking. So with the Higgs, it's not quite clear what it is you're trying to do other than to interest people or possibly to get them to buy your book.
Is there an interview on the Higgs thing?
Well, I read a lot of articles about the Higgs, so people tried hard and some articles were sort of understandable, I don't think. So anyway, you saw how the difference is and how much difference it makes if you really try to be understandable for lay people, right?
Also, the interviewer asked him timely questions, right? I mean, like Charlie Rose is like falling asleep, and she was talking, and if you give her like a long stretch of time to talk, like she might just stray into some technical stuff, right? I mean,
so it's an interaction,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You always have two people. There are two real people in that room, and the interaction is that what makes it. And I just put down a couple of thoughts I had on the issue. You had even more. You can put yours on the same slide. The interview is supposed to make you curious. You want to hear more. If you think after the second question, no, I don't have this question, I'm not interested, then you just switch it off. Yeah? And it should answer the questions that you have in mind. So the interviewer should be a person that sort of understands his audience questions, or sort of, is saying what they might ask. And there should be a way, somewhere where it's going, a red line aiming somewhere, and it might even be entertaining. I also have a recommendation for you. I know that Brian Greene is also somebody not everybody likes, but the interview on NPR Fresh Air is really a good one. I mean, two people are good here. We have a professional interviewer and a professional scientist answering these questions. So if you have a lot of time and sit in your car, you might just want to listen to it one day. So now I have a final example for you. It's very lighthearted. It's nothing serious. Don't take it too serious. But look at the body language and how these two people interact. I mean, you learned so much within the last 45 minutes that now you are experts on looking at this interview. It's from The Daily Show, and I hope you like it.
I am Clark, a best-selling author and an astrophysicist of the American Museum of Natural History. He's new book is called The Pluto Files, The Rise and Fall of America's Favorite Planet. Please welcome back to the show, Neil deGrasse Tyson. The compelling story of how you destroyed Pluto's life.
Sorry. I just try to find whether I can make it a little louder. I don't know whether this influences anything.
Oh, yeah.
Not too much, all right. I don't want to blow your ears.
This, the compelling story of how you destroyed Pluto's life. Pluto was, since 1930, a planet. He had stature, he had friends. You come along and say,
I just want to say, Pluto was an oddball from the beginning. Its orbit crossed the orbit of Neptune, its tenth out of the plane of the other planets. It's the littlest one out there. There's 7 moons bigger than Pluto. Pluto's mostly ice by volume. You bring Pluto where Earth is, Sun will get that way. Brethren that was just discovered in the outer solar system, and the New York Times put the page one story, Pluto not a planet, only in New York. And this, the beginning of hate mail because of Pluto, hate mail from third graders because of this.
You read about how it was discovered by a gentleman in New Mexico. They have refused in New Mexico.
New Mexico is playing hardball. New Mexico, Clyde Tombaugh, the discoverer of Pluto, by the way, he discovered it in Arizona, but lived in New Mexico.
New Mexico is playing.
They claim it, and he lived there and died there, fine. When they heard the astronomers were voting to demote Pluto, they passed resolutions with rules, whereas Pluto was discovered by one of our native sons, and our state, no matter what else the astronomers say, is a planet and within our borders.
Within New Mexico.
That's right.
Ridiculous.
People are crazy. I blame it on the dog. Because people in Europe don't behave this. It's Americans that behave this.
Pluto is that it has the name of the Disney dog.
I have no other accounting for this. Because Americans, it's a dog.
We're crazy for it.
Pluto, the dog was first sketched in 1930, the same year that the planet was found, the object formerly known as a planet.
Are you going to downgrade? Are you going to downgrade Pluto the dog to something else?
Well, actually, Mickey wrote a memo to the Disney family. Mickey the Mouse wrote a memo to the Disney family saying, "That's okay, Pluto, if you're a dwarf. We have 7 other dwarfs you can join."
Oh my God!
But Mickey was like, "Cause we're reclassified as a dwarf planet, right?" And so he said, "We love our 7 dwarfs, and you'll just be our star."
Why is everybody then kissing Pluto's ass? I think Pluto can handle it.
I think so too. Pluto's cool. And by the way, Pluto is a really sort of cockeyed planet, but if you look at the other stuff out there in the solar system, it behaves just the way Pluto does. So Pluto has brethren on
it. It should be with family.
It's happier there, I think. Yeah.
I think honestly, keep telling yourself that.
Okay. So I hope you liked it. Yeah?
I just want to say, if you didn't talk fast, you couldn't, this conversation depended very much on how fast you were speaking. It's the same thing you were saying, if he says it slowly, it's not.
But you think the joke was that he was so fast?
It changes the mood of the conversation. If someone is more, I don't know, I think it makes a difference.
It's the whole atmosphere.
Yeah.
Okay.
First thing he said was Pluto had it coming, right? And he said it quickly, and it sort of went from there. That the whole interview was kind of going to be a joke.
Any more remarks?
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of a genius in getting scientific information to the public in a way that's understandable and interesting, right? He's excellent at this. If you see your public lectures, he's really good at it.
And well, they seem to have a lot of fun out there, right?
They have a lot of fun. He has a lot of fun. He makes a lot of jokes. People appreciate that. And he can make jokes about science that are not geeky. He's impressive.
Yeah, I personally think this is a great match, right? John Stewart and him, this is just, they sort of, they go together. And that's, I think that's maybe something for you to keep in mind, that the way you interact with the journalist as a person, not with the institution, the media, but with that particular person, is very much influencing the outcome of what is happening there. So if the chemistry is not good, then it will never be something winning the Pulitzer Prize. Right? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.